Chapter 81. Feet long by 43 wide. And it is a marble chair which Helena used to sit in, while she superintended her workmen, when they were digging and delving for the true cross. And this place is an altar dedicated to Saint Dimas, the penitent thief. A new bronze statue is here, a statue of Saint Helena. It reminded us of poor Maximilian, so lately shot. He presented it to this chapel, when he was about to leave for his throne in Mexico. From the cistern we descended 12 steps into a large roughly shaped grotto, carved wholly out of the living rock. Helena blasted it out when she was searching for the true cross. As he had a laborious piece of work, here, but it was richly rewarded. Out of this place she got the crown of thorns, the nails of the cross, the true cross itself, and the cross of the penitent thief. When she thought as he had found everything, and was about to stop, she was told in a dream, to continue a day longer. It was very fortunate. She did so, and found the cross of the other thief. The walls and roof of this grotto still weep bitter tears in memory of the event that transpired on Calvary, and devout pilgrims groan and sob when the sad tears fall upon them from the dripping rock. The monks call this apartment the Apple of the Invention of the Cross, a name which is unfortunate, because it leads the ignorant to imagine that a tacit acknowledgement is thus made, that the tradition that Helena found the true cross here is a fiction, an invention. It is a happiness to know, however, that intelligent people do not doubt the story in any of its particulars. Priests of any of the chapels and denominations in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre can visit this sacred grotto to weep and pray, and worship the gentle Redeemer. Two different congregations are not allowed to enter at the same time, however, because they always fight. Still marching through the venerable Church of the Holy Sepulchre, among chanting priests in coarse long robes and sandals, pilgrims of all colors and many nationalities, in all sorts of strange costumes, under dusky arches, and by dingy piers and columns, through a somber cathedral gloom freighted with smoke and incense, and faintly starred with scores of candles that appeared suddenly and as suddenly disappeared, or drifted mysteriously hither and thither about the distant aisles like ghostly jack-o'-lanterns, we came at last to a small chapel which is called the Chapel of the Mocking. Under the altar was a fragment of a marble column. This was the seat Christ sat on when he was reviled, and mockingly made king, crowned with a crown of thorns and sceptered with a reed. It was here that they blindfolded him and struck him, and said in derision, "Prophesy, who it is that smote thee?" The tradition that this is the identical spot of the mocking is a very ancient one. The guide said that Seawolf was the first to mention it. I do not know Seawolf, but still, I cannot well refuse to receive his evidence, none of us can. They showed us where the great Godfrey and his brother Baldwin, the first Christian kings of Jerusalem, once lay buried by that sacred sepulchre they had fought so long, and so valiantly to wrest from the hands of the infidel. But the niches that had contained the ashes of these renowned crusaders were empty. Even the coverings of their tombs were gone, destroyed by devout members of the Greek Church, because Godfrey and Baldwin were Latin princes, and had been reared in a Christian faith whose creed differed in some unimportant respects from theirs. We passed on, and halted before the tomb of Melchizedek. You will remember Melchizedek, no doubt. He was the king who came out, and levied a tribute on Abraham the time that he pursued Lot's captors to Dan, and took all their property from them. That was about 4,000 years ago, and Melchizedek died shortly afterward. However, his tomb is in a good state of preservation. When one enters the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the sepulchre itself is the first thing he desires to see, and really is almost the first thing he does see. The next thing he has a strong yearning to see is the spot where the Savior was crucified. But this they exhibit last. It is the crowning glory of the place. One is grave and thoughtful when he stands in the little tomb of the Savior. He could not well be otherwise in such a place, but he has not the slightest possible belief that ever the Lord lay there, and so the interest he feels in the spot is very, very greatly marred by that reflection. He looks at the place where Mary stood, in another part of the church, and where John stood, and Mary Magdalene, where the mob derided the Lord, where the angel sat, where the crown of thorns was found, and the true cross, where the risen Savior appeared. He looks at all these places with interest, but with the same conviction he felt in the case of the sepulchre, that there is nothing genuine about them, and that they are imaginary holy places created by the monks. But the place of the crucifixion affects him differently. He fully believes that he is looking upon the very spot where the Savior gave up his life. He remembers that Christ was very celebrated long before he came to Jerusalem. He knows that his fame was so great that crowds followed him all the time. He is aware that his entry into the city produced a stirring sensation, and that his reception was a kind of ovation. He cannot overlook the fact that when he was crucified there were very many in Jerusalem who believed that he was the true Son of God. To publicly execute such a personage was sufficient in itself to make the locality of the execution a memorable place for ages. Added to this, the storm, the darkness, the earthquake, the rending of the veil of the temple, and the untimely waking of the dead, were events calculated to fix the execution and the scene of it in the memory of even the most thoughtless witness. Fathers would tell their sons about the strange affair, and point out the spot. The sons would transmit the story to their children, and thus a period of 300 years would easily be spanned. The thought is Mr. Prime's, not mine, and is full of good sense. I borrowed it from his tent life. M.T. At which time Helena came and built a church upon Calvary, to commemorate the death and burial of the Lord, and preserve the sacred place in the memories of men. Since that time there has always been a church there. It is not possible that there can be any mistake about the locality of the crucifixion. Not half a dozen persons knew where they buried the Savior, perhaps, and a burial is not a startling event, anyhow. Therefore, we can be pardoned for unbelief in the sepulchre, but not in the place of the crucifixion. 500 years hence there will be no vestige of Bunker Hill Monument left, but America will still know where the battle was fought, and where Warren fell. The crucifixion of Christ was too notable an event in Jerusalem, and the Hill of Calvary made too celebrated by it, to be forgotten in the short space of 300 years. I climbed the stairway in the church which brings one to the top of the small enclosed pinnacle of rock, and looked upon the place where the true cross once stood, with a far more absorbing interest than I had ever felt in anything earthly before. I could not believe that the three holes in the top of the rock were the actual ones the crosses stood in, but I felt satisfied that those crosses had stood so near the place now occupied by them, that the few feet of possible difference were a matter of no consequence. When one stands where the Savior was crucified, he finds it all he can do to keep it strictly before his mind that Christ was not crucified in a Catholic church. He must remind himself every now and then that the great event transpired in the open air, and not in a gloomy, candle-lighted cell in a little corner of a vast church, upstairs a small cell all bejeweled and bespangled with flashy ornamentation, in execrable taste. Under a marble altar like a table, is a circular hole in the marble floor, corresponding with the one just under it in which the true cross stood. The first thing everyone does, is to kneel down and take a candle, and examine this hole. He does this strange prospecting with an amount of gravity that can never be estimated or appreciated by a man who has not seen the operation. Then he holds his candle before a richly engraved picture of the Savior, done on a messy slab of gold, and wonderfully rayed and starred with diamonds, which hangs above the hole within the altar, and his solemnity changes to lively admiration. He rises and faces the finely wrought figures of the Savior, and the malefactors uplifted upon their crosses behind the altar, and bright with the metallic luster of many colors. He turns next to the figures close to them of the Virgin and Mary Magdalene, next to the rift in the living rock made by the earthquake at the time of the crucifixion, and an extension of which he had seen before in the wall of one of the grottos below. He looks next at the showcase with a figure of the Virgin in it, and is amazed at the princely fortune in precious gems and jewelry that hangs so thickly about the form as to hide it like a garment almost. All about the apartment the gaudy trappings of the Greek church offend the eye, and keep the mind on the rack to remember that this is the plus of the crucifixion, Golgotha, the Mount of Calvary. And the last thing he looks at is that which was also the first, the place where the true cross stood. That will chain him to the spot, and compel him to look once more, and once again, after he has satisfied all curiosity, and lost all interest concerning the other matters pertaining to the locality. And so I close my chapter on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the most sacred locality on earth to millions and millions of men, and women, and children, the noble and the humble, bond and free. In its history from the first, and in its tremendous associations, it is the most illustrious edifice in Christendom. With all its claptrap sideshows, and unseemly impostures of every kind, it is still grand, reverend, venerable, for a god died there. For 1500 years its shrines have been wet with the tears of pilgrims from the earth's remotest confines. For more than 200, the most gallant knights that ever wielded sword wasted their lives away in a struggle to seize it, and hold it sacred from infidel pollution. Even in our own day a war, that cost millions of treasure and rivers of blood, was fought because two rival nations claimed the sole right to put a new dome upon it. History is full of this old Church of the Holy Sepulchre, full of blood, that was shed, because of the respect and the veneration in which men held the last resting place of the meek and lowly, the mild and gentle, Prince of Peace. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.